Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady, but you're not hearing much from me today because this week it's a St Anthony podcast.
We come on this loop, John B. My grandfather and me. Around Nassau town we did roam.
I know, I've gone for the easy route with Brian Wilson being our Celtic podcast guest, but what do you expect? Anyway, it is St Anthony taking us a chat along with Celtic historian, director, author, politician, businessman, lecturer, friend of Lawrence Donegan, Mr Brian Wilson. But before I get on to the podcast with St Anthony, just a little bit about our appeal from the Celtic FC Foundation. On Wednesday the 1st of February, they are planning to carry out some promotion on the Celtic Way in celebration of the Walford's Wish campaign, distributing selfie boards, flyers and stickers. If you would be interested in helping them out and can get to Celtic Park around 6pm on that night, if you can contact the Celtic FC Foundation, and you can do that by email on cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk, that's cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk, or you can go on the Foundation website. Anyway, enough of me. This is him, St Anthony, with him, Brian Wilson.
Welcome to another Celtic Underground podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Celtic director Brian Wilson, who is fresh from the game at Airdrie, where Celtic have just beaten Albion Rovers. And I think we should start off by saying, Brian, what was your opinion on the game today?
I thought it was just a good professional job, that there was never any danger, and I thought Albion Rovers, they obviously went out to defend very deep. They did it pretty effectively, and just patience paid off. And I thought Scott Sinclair was outstanding, and just Patrick Roberts, when he came on, just gave a different twist to it. So a good professional job, but all credit to Albion Rovers for the resistance they put up.
It's a kind of Celtic are not a lose-lose situation in this, because obviously if you lose the game it's a major embarrassment, and if you win the game you don't get any credit. So it's often a, but you know, we're not going to get any credit for this, we just move on to the next round now. And
no, but I think it, you know, I was there last year, you know, when it was East Kilbride, and even then you're just a wee bit wary of the banana skin. But I think that's just a symptom of how things have changed, that there was, you know, just confidence, competence, and the job was done. But you can slip up. I mean, I'm sure we all remember Clyde, and remember Morton and the League Cup, and you know, games like that. So it can go wrong, but there was never any danger of that today, I'm pleased to say.
So understand as well that you met Rod Stewart behind the scenes today.
Yeah, Rod was there. He was in the boardroom, and he was in the, there was actually a wee bit, something I don't think anybody likes is we're sitting behind glass today, you know, like in a box, and which kind of really doesn't give you much of the atmosphere. And so you know, Rod was in with the Celtic group, and he was in good form, but
It kind of came across in the television when he did the draw that he was maybe slightly inebriated, but you're saying there that he was just monkeying about, and you know, he's normal Rod.
All I can say is there was absolutely no sign of that. I think he's a personality. When he goes in front of a camera, he's going to ham it up a bit, but I can absolutely say there was
was brilliant entertainment. So it was absolutely surreal watching that. It was really good fun. So I think
we nearly managed to get it wrong.
We thought it was Morton at one point, and then it was Inverness. Yeah. So okay, we always start off the podcast by asking the following two questions. What was the first Celtic game you attended, and who was your first Celtic hero?
The first Celtic game I attended was against Raith Rovers in 1953, And I was quite surprised when I checked back, you know, exactly. I remember it, I've got quite clear memories of it, and Celtic won 3-0. But I was really surprised to find I was only 4 when I went in my first game, you know, so mm-hmm. I'd have thought I was a wee bit older. But that was Celtic 3, Raith Rovers nothing at Celtic Park in the league. The first kind of big game I went to was, I think, would it be the following season, so it was 50-55, I think it was, and it was a Scottish Cup semi-final against Airdrie, and it was unforgettable because straight from the kick-off, without a Celtic player touching the ball, Airdrie scored. And what does a wee boy do? You know, you're just a bit in tears, you know, with you.
Devastated.
And it was funny because we're actually, just to the context, we're speaking just now in the Blythewood Hotel, and one of the concierge guys here was a big Airdrie fan, and just quite recently, we were having a laugh about that, and he told me he'd been to the guy who scored the goals, a guy called Billy Reid, and he was inducted into the Airdrie Hall of Fame, and they'd shown a video mm-hmm. of that goal in that semi final, and he sent it to me, and it was amazing. It was exactly as I remember. It was, you know, from
memory,
that time,
yeah.
From memory, I suppose I was 5 maybe, mm-hmm. and it was exactly as I remembered it had been scored. And anyways, the Celtic equalised later on and won the replay.
So in terms of hero then, who was your first hero as a kid?
First hero, well, these at that time it was a kind of, you know, Warner, Hockney, Rollo, Evans, Stephen Peagle, it was that kind of team.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose, these were the names I grew up with, but I suppose, the you know, when I was just a wee bit older, I would say Billy McNeil was probably the first hero. You know,
is that in terms of the leadership?
In terms of the leadership and just his whole presence mm-hmm. and he was a really quite iconic figure even well before Lisbon.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, where did you hail from at this point? Were you Glasgow born and bred?
No, I grew up in Dunoon.
We're going to come on to that in a wee minute, but that must have been quite a trek in those days to get from Dunoon to Glasgow.
It was a trek. It had to be done with kind of military precision, you know, because there weren't many ferries in these days, and so we'd have to leave just absolutely, you know, work your way back through the crowd to be at the back, just at the final whistle,
and then
walk into Central Station, get the train, get the ferry, and it had to be done in or else because there were no more ferries. So, but yeah, it was. It obviously didn't go every game at that time, but. It was pretty
so what led you towards Celtic? Did you come from a Celtic background or a Celtic family, or was it just
No, pure conditioning, which I'm very grateful. But my my father was a very big Celtic supporter, strong Celtic supporter, and I always tell a story, you know, I literally my first memory was being, you know, spoon fed, you know, from your a baby it's all been fed to Celtic teams, you know, and every, you know, I remember, you know, it was like Kenaway, Hogan, Morrison, Geaton's, Lyons and Patterson, Delaney, Crum, McDonald, Delaney, Crum, Diverson, Murphy, you know, it's like, and that's imprinted from that time. So there was never any doubt. And my father was, the first politics really that I was aware of was Irish politics, you know, and my father had a very strong kind of interest in Irish politics and the injustices of Irish politics and so on, and it all kind of fitted together. And it was unknown, because I didn't come from maybe the usual Celtic background, but it was through his interests and his conditioning, as I say, for which I've always been.
Because I'm always interested to hear people talk about the you know, I come from an inner city Catholic background, but when I was a kid being brought up in the 70s, then it was almost automatic that you would support Celtic in view of the things that were happening about you at the time. I'm always enchanted with stories of people who, for further afield, for whatever reason, and the sacrifices that people make, because when you stay in Glasgow and you just jump in the supporters bus or the car to go to the game, you just take it for granted. But there must be a great fervour for people that travel a distance.
Well, I think there was, and I think it, you know, that it was all of a piece. I mean, that, you know, but the other thing, I didn't come from a Catholic background. And again, that was fairly unusual at that time. But there was a generation, and I would say that quite a lot of people in my father's generation who just hated the whole, you know, other side of the story and wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. And so were attracted to Celtic by the fact they were always an inclusive club.
Mm-hmm. Have you been enlightenment, if you like?
No, it's enlightenment. Yeah. It's enlightenment. It was that they were an inclusive club. They were the, you know, they also had this Irish connection which attracted him, and they also played great football and had a great had a great narrative. You know, had a great story to tell. So it's all the things that draw, and probably, you know. But I'm always quite surprised. Once I live in Lewis now, you know, but I've always been quite interested, like you, in how many people there, which is not the most obvious, you know, breeding ground for Celtic supporters. But again, of that generation, there were a lot of people who, for these independent-minded reasons, had arrived at being Celtic supporters one way or the other, and there's still quite a strong, you know, a decent Celtic support there.
There's people maybe your age and maybe a wee bit younger and probably up to my age group. And it's funny how we spoke to them, and they said that when they were taken to Celtic Park for the first time, the thing that strikes them was a colour, because Taylor was black and white in those days. And when you see a football match for the first time in colour, with vivid strips, Celtic's green and white against Dundee United's tangerine and black, it's quite a vivid contrast. And you know, it's amazing the number of guys who say, I'll never forget the first time, just seeing it in colour for the first time, because you've saw it on TV, but it isn't the same until you actually... See it like that?
Oh, I think that's undoubtedly true. And of course, I mean, the time I'm talking about, there wasn't really TV. You know, you saw Pathé News in black and white occasionally, you know, but the whole atmosphere of it was phenomenal, and as it's continued to be. I think it's quite surprising. I look back at that Raith Rovers game that I mentioned. The crowd was 20,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't always.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Huge.
You don't have to get
numbers.
Back far to the 1980s, and the crowds were maybe in that spectrum, aside from the European games, the Rangers games, and Alec Ferguson's Aberdeen team.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's a fair point. So now, if you don't mind me saying, you're of a certain age, right? And you must remember Lisbon. So because we're coming up for the 50th anniversary, we're making a point now asking people what was your personal memories of the day.
Well, of the day, I'd been to the home games. I was a student in Dundee. It was my first year at university in Dundee, and we'd formed a wee Celtic supporters club in Dundee University, and we'd been at every home game in the run-up to Lisbon. But Lisbon itself was, I have no idea whether I'd have gone anywhere or could have afforded to go, but anyway, it was in the middle of exams of my first year at university, and so I watched it in black and white, and then we had, like everyone else, we celebrated long and hard. But as you know, we might come on to this sort of some of the things, the history things I've done. But one of my great privileges in the relationship with Celtic was to go back to Lisbon with Billy McNeil the history DVD, and we walked him through from the dressing room to the centre of the pitch, you know.
I've never been, but I've heard people say that the wonderful thing is that stadium's not really changed that much.
It's not changed that much because it's not used.
Which is a good thing in view of the fact that it's still
totally. And
the
dressing rooms were pretty much as they were, and they were detached from the pitch. And so it was this walk through the tunnel. But the thing was that I was there. She's kind of give Billy a prompt or whatever, or ask him questions or something like that, as we did this. And just from start to finish, there was never any need to, he'd never missed a beat, he just, every step of the way. And it was a fantastic
thing. That must have been some experience.
It was some experience. And I think the DVD goes, is a lot, it's a long, I think it's four volumes or four CDs, but if there's one bit in it that I really enjoyed and was privileged to do, it was that walk with Billy. So that was my later experience of Lisbon, but on the day itself, I was in Dundee.
The other thing that's worth remembering about the European Cup final is when you see it these days, it's not unusual for the presentation to be made in a pitch and a podium.
Yeah.
It's obviously satisfactory, but to see Billy get up in that sort of Romanesque How could you describe it? The Colosseum somehow, it looked like something from the Roman days, and it's such a striking, even to this day, it's such a striking image, when he stands there surrounded by people with these big pillars, and you know, it's almost like Caesar addressing the masses.
Absolutely astonishing image. But his, you know, his only regret about the whole thing was that he was detached from the team at that time, because the presentation was on the other side. But there was a moat that he, it was a moat to kind of keep, to separate from the pitch. And again, he just, you know, he had no recollection of how he could have possibly cleared that moat, you know. But it was great. My best memory of that of that campaign was behind the goal, Billy's goal against Vojvodina in the quarter final, Charlie Gallagher's corner in
the last minute. There was almost a replay in Rotterdam.
I mean, if you're talking about epics, that was an epic moment. Just
I remember my dad saying, actually, God rest him, that he said that he never believed up to that point that they could win. It was just an adventure. And that night when they got to the semi-finals, he actually remembers some of these friends talking, my God, we didn't miss out winning this. Yeah. We've came from almost nowhere and no great expectations, and now we're in the cusp of something wonderful.
Yeah, and I think it was so much better a tournament in some ways, you know, because you had that, that, you know, the off chance, or as it turned out, the reality of someone unexpected doing it, because it was round by round, so you were, when you did that, you were two rounds away from winning.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, out of interest, you had the privilege in 1988 of writing the centenary book, so that must have been a great experience, delving into the club's history.
It was great. I mean, I'm a journalist by trade, and one of the things I was doing at that time, Ian Archer had been the Scottish football... Ian worked for the Herald at that time. Great football writer, Ian. Great writer. And then Ian went to the Express, and he'd done a kind of sideline of the Guardian. He was a Guardian Scottish football correspondent as well. So when he moved to the Express, he couldn't do that. So he handed that over to me. Mm-hmm. So I became undoubtedly Scotland's least read football writer, writing.
Were you a journalist before an MP then?
Oh yeah.
Oh
yeah,
I never realised that.
Yeah, and so I wrote the Guardian, and I think just there weren't that many pro Celtic. Uh-huh. You had a kind of freedom in the Guardian that not many people read it, and it was through that really that Jack McGinn asked me if I would do the centenary book. And it was a fantastic thing to do, I got access to stuff that I don't think many people would have access to.
Is it true you get access to the old board minutes?
Yes, it is. I mean, I with great openness, I have to say that I used to go up to, at that time, things were pretty much run out of Desmond White's office in
West Nile Street,
in Bath Street, and so I went up there, and Chris White, you know, I think he was the company secretary then, and he just gave me the minutes.
And is it how far did the minutes go back?
It went back to the 30s. There'd been a fire in the 30s, they went back to the 30s. But they covered the whole. I mean, obviously they covered some
landmark.
Oh, really, really interesting stuff, you know. And I don't know. I mean, Chris is a nice guy, but there was a high degree of trust, because there was stuff in there which, in the wrong hands, wouldn't have been particularly favourable. But they gave insight into a lot of episodes, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, episodes, you know, like the flag episode that, you know, where you kind of, the drama was being played out, and in these meetings, the whole way arrival of Jockstein, and there was lots of things which, you know, without that first, you know, source material, first hand documentary thing, that you don't really have the story. Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, you know, I think there's loads of people, you know, who were better qualified than me to do the, the football side of the book. But I think, you know, maybe what I did that, not many would have done, was I really wanted to get the origins. Yeah, I really wanted to get the reality.
The founding fathers,
and it was in danger of developing into a wee bit of a fairy tale in which, you know, it was Brother Walfred and, you know, that was it kind of thing, and, you know, obviously a very major figure, but there were other very major figures who, and there was also the very strong, it was so much the social history of the Irish in Glasgow, and also it linked closely into the political history of the Irish in Glasgow and why they made the decisions they did about how to move forward as a community. And I think that I think maybe it rescued it from being an oversimplified story. Mm-hmm. And I think that anyone who does read the book and is interested in that sort of stuff, that I think that it's important social history as well as football history.
I think that when I read books such as your own and the other books that have been brought out about the club's origins, the thing that always strikes me, and I never fully appreciated it before, is that they were a community club. It was basically three parishes who were getting together for the good of the locals. Now, when you see us as a worldwide club that we are at the moment, and you've got the internet, and you've got the mass support that we've got all over the world, it's easy to forget that this came from very very humble beginnings.
Very, very humble beginnings. Yeah, very humble beginnings, but very much. But that was a reflection of the way the Irish had congregated, had been had created congregated into a relatively small part of the city, but also it was following the example of Hibs in Edinburgh was to some extent the inspiration of it, but the whole thing about the importance of it being an inclusive club, that this was it was a statement, and they had to make the same decision. In politics, the Irish, the first generation Irish there, they had to make a decision whether to form an Irish party, or whether to go into what was then the developing Labour movement and become part of a wider progressive integration.
Yeah.
And in the same way, they had to decide whether to be a Catholic exclusivist Irish club or whether to, become a, obviously, with a very strong identity in that direction, but also building into wider Scottish society. And the crossover of people was very strong. When you find, Michael Davitt was actually quite a significant player, and but the big people in the Irish community in Glasgow were big in politics, and they were big in Celtic.
Yeah, yeah. So, was it 1987 you became an MP?
It was 1987 I became an MP.
So, I remember, I think it was a female MP that started a Celtic supporters club in the House of Commons. Would that be right?
Certainly, one of the founders of it was Bridget Prentice, who was actually, was born next door to St Mary's Hall. She was certainly from, or is from, that part of Glasgow, but she was an MP for a London constituency, and there was lots of it was quite a big organisation, because there was all sorts of staff
So was it just for MPs then?
It wasn't just for MPs. It was people who worked in the House of Commons.
I never appreciated that. No,
and it was actually a guy, the MP, one of the people who was the secretary of it, if I remember rightly, was the wife of an MP called Jim Dobbin, who was a fifer, and he was an MP for a Manchester constituency. And his wife sort of administered it, but I have no idea whether it still functions. But and there were issues in which it was quite helpful to have parliamentarians who were supporting Celtic's corner.
So does absence make the heart grow fonder? Because I know London isn't that far away, but that this is probably before the days of live television, and you maybe not be able to go home every weekend or whatever, depending on your business. Was it difficult to support them from a distance?
Well, I was home every weekend. Probably was actually. It was because at that time I also had a young, most of the time as an MP, a young family as well. So it's a strange job, and it is very time consuming.
I can imagine.
But I think the Celtic Sports Club, it was a statement. We've got all these people who are in Parliament and are very proud to be associated with Celtic.
Good stuff. Now, you know, you're a director, obviously, of the club at the moment. Now, I think you're a non-executive director.
Yeah.
So, for my information, for the people listening, what's the difference between non-executive and executive directors?
Well, the executive are the people who are the employed to run the affairs of the, you know, the top tier of management, if you like, which is Peter Lowell is the chief executive, and Chris Mackay is the finance director. They're executive directors,
mm-hmm.
And the non-executive directors are the board, if you like,
mm-hmm.
Who are, you know, obviously not full time by any means,
mm-hmm.
but who have a responsibility for the running of the company, and also, I suppose, to supervise the executive. So it's just, I mean, it's because of the nature of the organisation, it's a public.
Yeah,
limited company, and that is the way the board is a necessary part of that structure, and it's, you know, it's really the board's not involved in the football, obviously.
Indirectly,
the board is there to ensure the sound management of the club and the company.
So, how did it become that you became a director? Do you get an invite, or is it something?
Well, it's by pure, you know, again, just by you know, one of the great privileges of my life. And I think it's one of these things, if you set out with that ambition, you'd never get anywhere near it. I certainly didn't. I never in my wildest dreams expected to be a director of Celtic. I suppose since I did the book, I was, you know, I was closer to the affairs of the club, and then I had a decent relationship with Fergus McCann, and then, you know, it changed over, and it was Brian Quinn who asked me initially if I'd be interested when I'd indicated I was coming out of politics,
mm-hmm.
and surprisingly enough, I said, yeah, I would be interested, and so that I. You know, but as I say, it's not something that you, if you seek it, you probably don't get it. You almost certainly don't get it, and it's a huge privilege, and it's been just a wonderful thing to be part of.
So, for the uninitiated such as myself, how often would the board meet? Is it quarterly, monthly, or
no? It doesn't. It probably meets formally maybe about six times in the year. But, you know, obviously there's a lot of informal contact in between times. There's strategy days once a year, there's the annual general meeting, and then because we're all, the reason we're there is we're Celtic supporters, you know, there's a lot of contact at games and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the role of the board is to make sure, and, you know, and I think people, you know, obviously events elsewhere have sharpened the focus on the fact that it's not automatic that things are.
Yeah, I was going to make that point actually, because directors often get blamed when things go wrong, and I've been guilty of that in the past, hands up. But, you know, I think the standing of the Celtic board has gone up in recent years because of the events that you're looking. I think Brian Quinn played a major factor in that, because I think he was I say sober in terms of his behaviour. He wasn't he always seemed quite an intelligent man, but a modest man, a quiet guy. But he gave leadership to Celtic at a time when you know it would have been easy to maybe run up pay daft transfers and run up debts and the rest of the stuff.
Yeah.
And I think Brian Quinn sort of in some ways educated the supporters that, you know, we do have to cut our cloth accordingly because of the league that we play in.
I think that's 100% right. I mean, I think Brian was as good a chairman as you could get of any football club, and a very, very passionate, lifelong Celtic supporter. But I think we leave aside the board. But I think, you know, I think we have, I think the ownership relationship, the again, if you're going to have a major shareholder, I don't think we could have a better one than what we've got in terms of commitment and interest. I don't think we could have a better chief executive. I just think we're really well served, and
Well, you're holding to Peter Lobo there. I mean, it must be difficult for him running the Scottish game.
It's I know
if you believe certain individuals
from the mighty viewpoint of St. Mm. Mim. I mean, you know, I think it's self-evident that the club is well. Leave aside the football matters, which obviously are in a good place just now, but I just think that the running of the long-term stable future of Celtic has been well served.
Is there sometimes a conflict between being a supporter and being a director? Because, you know, you've been a supporter since you were four, and you know, when things aren't going well on the park, or you know, you probably get a supporter's head and a director's head. Is there a conflict of interest at times?
Well, I think you have to understand the role of a director. You know, I mean, you know, there's aspects of Celtic which I'm utterly unqualified to have an opinion on, except as a supporter. You know, and therefore don't pretend otherwise, and don't be allowed to pretend otherwise. But you know, that's not the role of the board. I mean, like any other company, you hire management, and the management do the job, and they stand or fall by the job that they do, whether that's on or off the park. But you know, I think it's very important, and I think it's where a lot of football clubs go wrong, is that the directors don't understand where their responsibilities begin, where they end.
And of course, I think the one thing we're grateful for in hindsight is that we didn't have one overall controlling person who could, like a dictator, if I can describe it in a football sense. You know, but it was very much a collective. Even when Fergus was there, I remember reading a quote that Fergus said one day. He goes, you know, I might not be the best at what I do, but I think I'm good at picking people who are good at what they do. And when you look at Brian Quinn getting brought in at that point, and a whole assortment of other people, I think Fergus was good at that.
It was absolutely right. Well, I mean, it was Fergus who set the bar pretty high on the caliber of the board he was looking for, and I exempt myself from it, but I think it's been maintained as a high quality. That it would be a board that would sit comfortably with much bigger. Bigger companies.
Mm. Just to touch on politics a wee bit, I know when you and I were discussing getting together, you were in Cuba last week on a visit, and I'm quite fascinated by that because obviously Fidel Castro has passed away fairly recently, and he was such a major figure of the 20th century for so many years, and I understand that you actually met him a few times.
Yeah, I mean, in 1998, I became, quite unexpectedly, I guess, I became the UK Trade Minister, and I just made an interest in Cuba, and I'm not starry-eyed, I know what's wrong, and I know that, you know, the pros and cons, but I still think it's a country which gives another model, which, and its emphasis on the health, education, and you know, there's no, you know, so one of the most impressive poster you see in Cuba maybe is, you know, there's X 100 million children starving in the world. There's none of them are in Cuba, you know. So that's a big thing to me, and I always had an interest, but purely on the commercial side. You know, that I didn't like the fact that that Britain had sort of followed the American lead and really didn't have a commercial relationship with Cuba. So I went to. I went and I was the first sort of British minister that had been there for quite a while, and I went straight into a dinner when I arrived with Fidel, and actually developed quite a good relationship with him. And
can he speak English?
Well, he can't. He always had the same interpreter with him. He can't speak English. He could. He had a good command of English, but he always spoke Spanish through the. Through the interpreter, but it was good, you know. And again, going back to the fact that I'm a journalist by trade, that I kind of discovered early, you know, I realised early on that in balance, you know, he probably had more to tell me than I had to tell him. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was fantastic to get, to ask about the Bay of Pigs, to ask about the whole.
All American situation, some of the
stories to tell. But on the other hand, the other thing that I discovered was that he also he liked to be challenged, and so you could have a, you could have an argument with him.
A debate?
He wasn't like sitting there listening to a monologue. Anyway, I got to know the Cubans pretty well, and they, you know, I still do. And when I came out of politics in 2005, that they asked me to come back and be involved in energy issues. So the result of that was that we formed a joint venture to develop biomass energy plants in Cuba, and I'm still involved in. Mm-hmm. Still involved in that, so that's what I was there for.
It's kind of fascinating. I find the whole Cuban thing fascinating because it very much divides opinion. You get half of the people are happy the way that Castro thumbed his nose at the Americans and you know, behaving the way he behaved, and yet there's other people who say that he was quite a cruel dictator and he treated his people badly. So you know, I think it divides opinions. One of those guys, you either love him or hate him.
Well, I know which side I come down on in these two, you know, but I don't think it has to be as polarised as that. That you know, there's no perfect society, and I think the downside of Cuba are generally exaggerated, but. You know, I think what you've got to remember is that Cuba has lived under the blockade, the American blockade, for more than half a century. If we'd lived under an economic blockade, if we'd lived under the constant threat of invasion, you know, would every civil liberty be respected? You know, the blockade and the American, you know, a completely irrational American refusal to accept Cuba and to work. To you know, for a more constructive relationship, it's distorted everything, and it's also distorted the it becomes an excuse as well, because there are things that the Cubans should be doing, should have done, but there's always the excuse of the blockade. So sometimes the blockade's a reason, sometimes it's a rationalisation of why things as they are. But it's you know in relative terms, it's you know. As I say, there's no kids starving. There's no great wealth, but there's a lovely people and a great potential. And if only and hopefully the reforms that Obama has introduced will not be set back. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's now, as you say, I just came back this morning. I'm the only guy to have been straight from Havana to Airdrie, but but there's now direct flights, you know, to Atlanta, to Miami, to New York. I don't see that being reversed. You know, there's Sheraton hotels are in Havana now. You know, the Americans will not walk in on their own terms. The Cubans will set the terms of it. But I think it would be absolute madness to try to turn the clock back on that.
We're living in, I think. There's an old proverb that may you live in interesting times, but we're living in sort of strange times at the moment. But when you look at you've had the Scottish referendum, you've had Brexit, you've had Trump taking over, politics is in a state of flux at the moment.
It's in a weird place altogether. Mm. And particularly the American thing is very dangerous, and I've no idea. Nobody has any idea how that's going to pan out.
He's very much a maverick, isn't he? It's hard to see what kind of guy he's going to be, and being such a powerful man that he's not used to taking instructions or advice from anybody else. He's very much will want to do his own thing.
No, I mean the optimistic thing is that he'll be reined in and will be curtailed by the constraints of office, but he is so much the.
A loose cannon
that who knows. And when you see this pure idiocy about holding press conferences about how many people were at his inauguration, I mean, what kind of tone is that to set? So you've just from day to day almost you wouldn't know what. And that was I also had discussions about that in Cuba, because nobody knows what he'll do there. You know, his pragmatic thing would probably be to, as I say, to carry on with the.
For
the changes in relationship, but then you know, one morning he could wake up and decide that he's going to set it all back, or set back what he can by presidential decree.
So moving back to Celtic then, we're very successful. This season has been a joy so far. So how are you enjoying the football under Brendan Rodgers?
Immensely. I mean, I think it is football with Celtic way, you know, it's attacking football, it's beautiful to watch, and I think both with players who maybe had lost a bit of confidence, to see players like James Forrest and Stuart Armstrong, how they've evolved,
developed
this season is fantastic, and I think the signings that have been brought in have been very, very, very successful. And it was a great achievement that the whole structure of our game, which places such an incredible significance on what happens in July and August.
The Champions League qualifiers. So pressurised, aren't they?
So pressurised. Yeah. I mean, and we went this year to be going.
Did you go to Israel for the second leg?
I did, and that was one of the tensest.
Well, even watched it on television. Yeah. I mean, my son's 12, and I could see his face just the colour draining from. And all the years I've supported Celtic, I don't remember ever being as nervous as that in the last 10 minutes. Knowing that one goal,
it went on so long,
would send us out.
Yeah.
And yet somehow in the last 5 minutes or so, there was an inner strength.
Yeah.
It was almost as if the Israeli guys had run out of steam. But having said that, you were never quite 100% certain, because all it takes is a refereeing decision, a deflection, and the whole season comes crumbling down around you. It is very difficult.
It's crazy that so much hangs on these, as we all know, the problem has been in recent seasons is it's still a time of transition. You've got players coming in, you've got players leaving, and yet you have to get through these rounds as you say, it shapes the season. So I think for Brendan Tifford to come in and to have taken us through that period and into the group stages was in itself a fantastic.
I think we're very fortunate to have him. I mean, I think it says a lot for the board actually that they realised that there was a man of that calibre available, and there was a part of me that always hoped we would get him, because you read newspaper interviews and he always alluded to Tommy Burns and what a great man Tommy was, and Tommy had started him off when he went into coaching. And I'd also read interviews about his Irish background and how Celtic was. Most Irish guys have got Celtic is their club, but they also obviously have an English team to a degree. And he talked about that. So I must admit, even when he was Liverpool manager, I used to think, I'm sure one day we could end up with him as manager.
Well, I think it's self-evidently great that we have done, there's absolutely no doubt about his lifelong attachment to Celtic. Mm-hmm. So to have someone who not only has his pedigree but also his his emotional attachment and his loyalty to the club, I think, is a great combination.
I think he's got a stature as well, because when I think back in my lifetime, Jock Stein had it, Billy McNeil definitely had it, Martin O'Neill had it, Gordon Strachan I think had it to a degree. Always Gordon was a different personality, a very unique personality, and I also think Neil Lennon grew into the job.
Yeah.
He was a wee bit unsure at first, but he grew in standing as it went on, and I think a club like Celtic, you have to be a strong person to manage the club. I think I remember when Martin came and he said, people in England don't realise expectations up here. We expect to win every game, and it's totally unrealistic expectations in many ways, because when you go abroad and you play Bayern Munich or Real Madrid or whoever it is, I know personally, I think, we're Celtic, we should be competing with these guys.
Yeah.
And I don't think the English appreciate the pressure that a Celtic manager gets placed on them.
I think that's true, and I think probably Ronnie Dyla didn't, I think that anyone who comes into it who's not been in that cauldron or understands that cauldron, it is the shock of finding just what the level of expectation is and how little forgiveness there is, in the Scottish media for if there's any sign of weakness whatsoever. So, I think someone who really understands that, it's an asset. And obviously, did you say Neil Lennon? He had plenty of experience of it, and Brendan certainly does. But I mean, it's been a fantastic season so far, and I hope more to come.
Now, we're the biggest club in the country, or, you know, whatever way you want to equate it. And we're very much at the moment a big fish in a small pool, and the pool seems to be getting smaller as other leagues are becoming bigger. And it's only a general question. I don't want you to sort of think about this in the current time, but you know, after maybe when me and you are long gone, do you envisage a time when Celtic will play in a different environment?
Well, I hope it happens. We're still around to see it.
The point I'm trying to make is I don't think it's on the cards in the next 10, 15 years or so, but I'm looking well ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, would something have happened by now, I'd probably have said that it would have. I think the dynamic is not going to go away. And I think there has been some movement in that we are less... our position is less unique maybe than it was. We've been a big fish in a small pond. And the other thing that's happened is that the kind of ludicrous amounts of money that are floating about English football now because of the television deals, that has created a gap not only with small leagues like our own, but also with some of the other, you know, what were the bigger European leagues.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of clubs thinking, what is the structure that responds to that? So we can't dictate that. You know, you might want to go somewhere, but you can't go somewhere unless someone wants to take you. You know, But I think where we have a role to play is, and I think this is where Peter's role is so important, that Peter's involvement in the European Clubs Association and is just as his constant contacts within the game is that if an opportunity presents itself, then we are, you know, the critical thing is that we are in a position to
be ready
and to help to shape it. So these discussions, there's always discussions going on about, you know, one kind of league or another, or reshaping the European competitions and so on. And the important thing is, and I think this again is so important this year, to have got back into the group stages, to assert and to have someone of Brendan Rodgers' status there, is just always to keep ourselves as being regarded as a top European club.
We
must maintain that status. But I mean I think Celtic supporters, I think 99% of Celtic supporters understand the economic realities. You know, that we get £2 or 3 million a year from television money. The bottom team in the English Premiership got over £100 million. I mean, that is a gulf that.
There's a thing. You get the Sky TV deal. Mainly Sky, although BT Sport are in there as well. Has the glass ceiling been reached yet in this English thing? In terms of the money they're getting, or can it just keep going up and up and up?
Well, you'd think not. I mean, there are pressures on audiences, audience figures that suggest maybe it can't, but it's such an important leader for any company, any television company that's trying to get subscribers, that the money is phenomenal. And then you add to that the global interest, that it's not only in the UK the Premiership is such a big product, it's worldwide. And you know, so I think our job obviously has been to adapt to these circumstances and to find a formula that makes us credible competitors and keeps us up there in the upper echelons of European football. But the finances are crazy. As I say, there's a lot of other leagues and a lot of other big, respected European clubs who are now in quite a similar situation to our own.
So there's a collective interest there?
There's a collective interest. There's the ultra wealthy clubs of a collective interest. But then there's more clubs maybe in our own situation who see the dangers of that gap widening.
So just the last thing to say then, Brian, that you came out of politics in 2005. Well, how do you pass your time these days? What do you do? I'm sure you've got many interests apart from Celtic.
Well, I've got a few. As I say, I live in Lewis, and when my wife comes from Lewis, and we moved up there when I came out of politics, just for kind of family reasons. So, and I got involved there. I chair the company that makes Harris Tweed, which is a nice thing to be involved in. Again, we're surrounded with it in the Blyswood Hotel, pleased to say. And I do the Cuban stuff. I still do some journalism, and I'm a great privilege of being a director of Celtic. So, you know, I'm not...
Your
not,
time's full then.
I'm not idle.
Good man. Well, all it's left for me to say is thanks very much for giving us your time. I know you're a busy man and you've taken time to speak to us, and it's very much appreciated.
Thank you very much for asking.
Enjoyed that podcast, and there will be more along soon, as there will be more Celtic victories along soon, no doubt. Anyway, the next Celtic podcast is with one of the guys behind the Celtic Soul movie, and we'll be sticking a trailer up on YouTube prior to the podcast to give you an idea of what that is if you haven't read into it. However, you should. It's a great film, and it's a great chat with Owen O'Callaghan, one of the two guys, along with Jay Baruchel from the film, which will be making its European premiere at the Glasgow Film Festival, taking place at the GFT on Sunday the 26th of February. So more of that podcast. But this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night. Have more than one place to go. Any place he will play, his only concern is how much you'll pay. He's Mr. Know-it-all. If he shakes on a bed, kind of dude that won't pay his debt. Oh, he's Mr. Know-it-all. When you say that he's living wrong, he'll tell you he knows he's living right. And you'd be a stronger man if you took Mr. Know-it-all's advice. Oh, that dollar in his hand, he's Mr. Know-it-all. Take my word, please beware of a man that just don't give a care. No, he's Mr. Know-it-all. Don't you know it?